Studies in Foreign Policy, The Origins of Collective Security. Part 1. A podcast from Crowd Talks.
Hello and welcome to this Crowd Talks podcast. The podcast today is going to touch upon an issue in global foreign policy, which I had previously discussed in my earlier podcast on imperialism. This podcast today deals with a sort of related but different topic, which is the idea of collective security. Have you ever wondered why the United Nations exists and what's its background? What's its purpose? Why do certain members have privileges that others don't? Well, that's what we aim to explore in this podcast, how we ended up with an organisation like the United Nations and its oversight over global affairs. Now, if you're a complete newbie to all this stuff, you may not understand that the United Nations has a major connection to this thing called collective security. It's actually collective security that initializes the United Nations. My task in this talk today is to explain what this idea of collective security is, its history, and its impact on the practice of foreign relations. And if you've never heard the term collective security before, that's kind of good, since you're going to know a bit more about it once you get to the end of this podcast. This podcast is split into two parts. The first part of the podcast starts with the commencement of World War One and ends at the conclusion of the 1919 peace conference in France. The second part of the podcast takes off from the point where the first international organization dedicated to collective security starts to take shape after the peace conference and then goes up to the present day. So let's begin. Theoretically, collective security is an arrangement or an agreement between foreign states where an attack upon one of the states is treated as an attack upon all. The aggression is a fundamental concern for all the other states that are part of the agreement. It works in a similar way to an alliance agreement. So take, for instance, a multilateral alliance like NATO or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization for any newbies out there. The way these alliance agreements work is that if a state outside the alliance attacks another state inside the alliance, the other partners in the alliance would agree to defend the security of their attacked partner against the outsider. But I want to make one thing really, really clear at the start here. Collective security rejects alliances. Collective security requires a basic loyalty to all partners of the collective and not just subgroups. Where the collective idea comes from is the idea that all states, regardless of their particular attachments, have a vested interest in being secure from attack. It's this general principle that drives the arrangement. And if you are all committed to collective welfare, you can form a collective retaliatory response, which springs from the agreeing states towards the source of the aggression, which assists you with both a deterrent effect on potential aggressors and the possibility of direct countermeasures against actual aggressors or attackers. That's the theory, at least. But I do emphasise again that alliance-based agreements are not what we're really talking about here, because they're irreconcilable with pure collective security. Collective security is globally based. It's not regional or sectional. Agreement is based on all the nations being partners and all have an interest in being secure from attack. And this is how you get this idea of it being a community of power. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant gets some early credit for discussing cooperative international arrangements, though he didn't use that term collective security. The term collective security emerges much later. I think it's in the 1930s, sometime after the famous peace conference in 1919. And Winston Churchill, I am pretty sure, gets the credit for its invention. The idea, though, in different terminology, had been around for a century or two before Kant wrote his book called The Perpetual Peace. Now, I'm just going to take a bit of a shortcut here because the next idea is complex. Collective security could, at this point of theory, take a number of different forms. It could be a world government, a world court, or a world organization. There were a lot of debates around which form of these you could pursue, but we're not exploring these in any detail. In the 20th century, collective security formed around the idea that there would be a world organization to promote peace. That was the historical outcome of the debates and policy decisions. No world government, no world court. It would be an international organization, with the first of these being the League of Nations, and this was created at the end of the First World War. The second one, the one that we're probably all more familiar with because it still exists today, is the United Nations, and this was created at the end of the Second World War. And both these organizations, the League and the United Nations, become the focus of the global collective security movement. And this, of course, is the focus of our podcast today. Is there a counterpoint to collective security? Yes, there is, which is called the balance of power. The balance of power is another idea that attempts to stabilize international relations by decentralizing influence. The theory aims to prevent any single state from becoming dominant, and this involves forming alliances, increasing, you know, military spending or any other actions. The idea was that in practice, the balance would be self-regulating. So if a power could see another power that was actively destabilizing the balance, they would then use their assets at their disposal to prevent the destabilization of the balance. We get a good example of this in the period before World War I. The United Kingdom, or Great Britain, was the world's leading naval power, and it would maintain certain force ratios in its planning so it could ensure that it always had naval superiority. And when the Germans began to construct a proper blue water navy in the early 1900s, the reaction from Britain was that you needed to increase your military spending on naval assets, design and build more ships so that Germany couldn't acquire a critical superiority over Great Britain. Because since naval power was the central plank of British power projection in the world, any threat to it would destabilize the balance of power. And that's how a real world, that's a real world example of how the balance came into play. Both of these theories, balance of power, collective security, anchor two great academic schools of thought on foreign policy. On one side is the liberal international school, which is attached to and promotes collective security. And on the other hand is the real politique school, which promotes the balance of power. But the competition between these schools is a future development. And it does, though, grow out of the narrative that we explore in part one and part two of the podcasts. The balance of power, though, had, though, a long history preceding the First World War, which is our next port of call, because collective security is very much the child of the First World War. And the scale and the ferocity and the shock of that war promotes the agitation for collective security. Welcome back. I'm just going to, at this point, take a detour into the First World War as a topic itself. The war itself is the premier event of significance in general modern history, before and after. So if you ever wondered why your teachers banged on about it, that's the answer. And I've just had a flashback from when I was a teacher, as I said that. I had a student say to me once, and it was sort of stimulated a bit by the fact that the First World War looks and feels very distant from the present day. It's very much the olden days from the point of view of a young person in 2025. The photos, they're all black and white, and it looks old. And the student said to me once, why do we always study old people for? And the First World War is very significant for certain individual countries, in Europe in particular. It's less influential for some Asian countries, obviously, but it's the one event that I would urge an alien visitor, if they suddenly popped out of the sky, to study if they really wanted to know about modern humans. It answers a lot of questions in relation to geopolitics, combined arms warfare, extremist ideology, to name some. It's sort of like a introduction to how to put human society under maximum stress and see what rolls out afterwards. Let me kick off with the statement that the First World War was a global conflict, the first of its kind. You may be able to argue that the Napoleonic Wars were the first global conflict, but the First World War was certainly the first global conflict in the industrial era. The next part of our story has us looking at the United States and its president, Mr. Woodrow Wilson, in some detail. The listener might be thinking, how does the United States become significant to this story? It's not even involved in the war, and it's on the other side of the Atlantic. The answer to that dilemma is that the United States represented a very potent pool of potential power at this early point in the war. By 1913, the United States was by far the leading economy in the world. Nothing was even close. The other great powers could muster, at best, a gross domestic product of about half the United States. And in the case of Italy and France, it was even less. I will just also add that if you included some of Britain's colonies in the final GDP calculation, that might increase the UK's position and bring it closer to the United States' GDP value. The United States could be at this point in 1914, in terms of international politics, as being a bit stage shy. There are a few reasons for why it was aloof from the other great powers. One of them is that it alone had continuous democratic traditions, and it tended to sit outside the normal machinations of geopolitics. For the first 3 years of the World War, the United States sat on the sidelines, and it was able to prosper as both a seller of merchandise and a financier of war to the other powers. In only 4 years, by 1918, the United States' gross domestic product was double what it was 4 years before, a utterly amazing outcome. It became the effective banker of the Allied States during the period, and by holding those purse strings, it had a great deal of leverage. Everyone grasped that the United States had a massive potential as a co-combatant before it had entered the war. What I mean here is that aside from the economic advantages of engaging in trading with the United States as a neutral country, which is what the Allies were able to do in the first 3 years, if it actually decided to fight in the war with its mammoth war manufacturing capacity and double the population of the United Kingdom, you would win the war if it joined your side. It would utterly tip the scales in favour of the Allied side. And of course, this actually does happen. The Americans join the Allies, and their military influence upon the last 12 months of the conflict is decisive. The special position of the United States, once it became an Allied combatant, gave it a huge influence over any potential peace settlement that was going to be negotiated at the end of the war. Now, how that was to be wielded means we need to look closely at who was sitting in the White House. President Woodrow Wilson was an unusual occupant of the White House. He was the first Democratic Party president in a number of years, and in addition, he had an academic background. He was a historian by profession, and during his tenure as the head of Princeton University, he'd become the governor of New Jersey. He got a national profile from this and was elected president of the United States in 1912. Even though he lived and worked in the North during his later career, he was a Southerner by birth and upbringing. The influence of his Southern upbringing, though, would cling to him for the rest of his life. It was this unusual man who would become the midwife of modern collective security. Wilson had no real experience in foreign policy before he'd gone into politics. He wrote history as an academic. When he became president in 1912, after a short time as governor, at the time, I don't think anyone could have foreseen that Wilson's presidency would have become so dominated by foreign policy. But he didn't seem to lack confidence or lack preparation if that eventuality did occur. And oh boy, did it occur, because his presidency fundamentally became about foreign policy. During his early presidency, and as the administration progressed for its first years, he relied increasingly upon a shadowy member of his entourage, and this was a gentleman called Colonel Edward House. And House becomes his primary agent in foreign relations. One of Wilson's biographers, Christopher Cox, explores how House became advisor and confidant. And this occurred during the 1912 presidential campaign. And the two discovered that they shared identical views on virtually all political subjects. And Wilson would even state that Mr. House is my second personality. And Cox goes on to conclude that House was to become one of the most powerful Washington insiders in American political history. House advised Wilson not only on foreign matters, but domestic ones as well. This relationship, though, tended to overshadow Jennings Bryan in the State Department. And Jennings Bryan would resign in 1915. And thereafter, Wilson was to be virtually his own Secretary of State, with Colonel House as his emissary. Of course, the World War commences in 1914, and Wilson quickly declares US neutrality. And that was a popular domestic position with a pretty wide-ranging consensus. The war, though, was to hang over the remainder of his administration like a shadow, and it would define his presidency completely. The war, as you would expect, began to agitate the civic life of many of the nations, and not only the combatant nations, but also the neutral nations. And America had this experience. And one of the debates that commenced within the United States was, what was the final war settlement to be? What was to happen to the world? And there were discussions that promoted a new international peace organization to prevent future war. The leading organization of this type was called the League to Enforce Peace, and it was formed to promote an organization that would prevent future war. Wilson kept himself aloof from its deliberations, and probably for good reason, since a number of his political opponents were in its ranks and early supporters. And this wasn't by all means an American phenomenon either. There were also corresponding debates in Great Britain, and some of these activists were promoting quite radical changes to international relations. And I've foreshadowed these before in the first part of the podcast. Some, for example, were advocating a world government. The more moderate tended towards things like imposing compulsory arbitration or other forms of enforced dispute resolution when nations had a disagreement. How Wilson came to be entwined with the idea of an international peace organization is actually a bit opaque. If you were looking at him, at president at this time, the period 1914 to 1916, if you said this was going to be the guy who would take credit for the creation of the League of Nations, you would not have expected that to be so by virtue of his profile at the time. Privately, he had deep reservations about the existing international order. Before the war, Democratic Party politics had veered towards the anti-imperialist in sentiment, which Wilson had no problem with, but it tended to have this isolationist streak. Wilson is somewhat different here in that he expresses strong anti-imperialist sentiments, but differs from the traditional views in that he was prepared to gravitate America towards a more globalist outlook. And when war broke out in 1914, he privately began to sketch his own idea of a permanent structure for peace. But he keeps this all to himself. And it's not until he gives a speech to the League to Enforce Peace in May 1916 that you get some idea of what he's about here. He comes out publicly and declares his support for an international peace organization. He gives an important address to Congress in January 1917 that's been overshadowed by the later, more famous 14 points address that he gives in 1918. It's the 1917 address, though, that contains this important hint here. And he actually comes out in the speech and directly refers to the concept of the balance of power. And this is where he really establishes himself as a critic and an opponent of this way to manage foreign relations. We're starting to see the shapes here of two possible competing visions of how international order should be arranged. If you remember from the first part of the podcast, I refer to this concept, this balance of power, and how it had become in the preceding centuries one of the main pillars of foreign policy, where each state sought to maintain this balance. It was a situation where one power did not have too much power because it was counterbalanced by its rival's power. And provided a great power didn't disturb the balance, it could pursue its freedom of action. Though it was increasingly informed by the development of international law. Now, with Wilson rejecting the balance of power as an appropriate mechanism for managing foreign relations, we get some vague ideas of what it might be replaced with. This vagueness becomes an ongoing pattern with how Wilson communicates with people about the international organization. He becomes very cagey about the fine print and the final shape of what he would propose to be the foundational principles of the League and structure. We get a bit of insight into his thinking at this time with a conversation that he has with the French ambassador to the United States. Thomas Nock, who is one of Wilson's biographers, in the course of his research, dug out some correspondence between Tsar Saran, the ambassador, and the French foreign ministry, and he reports on a conversation that he has with Wilson in early 1917. In response to Tsar Saran's question as to whether a league could work in actual practice, Wilson apparently stated it was a good question, a very good question, but it would be an experience to try it. Not the most inspiring response. We're not talking about some type of situation where you're thinking of changing your brand of underwear, and we're going to buy a Kia as opposed to a Hyundai. We're actually talking about epic changes in foreign policy. And we have to fast forward to January 1918 to get to this. And by this stage, much has happened. The United States, led by Wilson, has declared war on Germany in April 1917. There's a series of incidents that leads up to the climax of the declaration. And if all that wasn't enough, there's also two revolutions in Russia. The first one was in February 1917, which results in a liberal regime coming to power. And then there's a second one in November, which results in a communist regime. By early 1918, there's been a remarkable change in geopolitics. When Wilson gives his fateful address to Congress on January 8th, the public hears for the first time what his plans are through his famous 14 points as the basis for the post-war peace settlement. And Wilson also expresses his views on what causes the war. For the purpose of our discussion, it's the last point, number 14, that's of most direct interest to us. I'm not going to read the whole thing out, but what it states there is that there should be a general association of nations that affords guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small states alike. So security, in other words. And this is our first official glimpse of US policy on the international organization. Well, the first public glimpse of it. But it's a very general statement, and we don't really see any real details of how it would work. And his reluctance to engage in detail with the public could well have reflected some of the doubts he had about it, about its viability. Later in 1918, House starts prodding Wilson to come up with more substance for the international organisation. And Wilson takes his advice and produces the first draft of what would be the Magnolia Covenant. And this is an outline of what the new international peace organisation will be based upon. The Germans capitulate in November 1918. So Wilson completes a final draft of his covenant just before the German capitulation. The German capitulation was formally drawn up in an armistice agreement. And for those non-foreign policy listeners out there, an armistice agreement is a ceasefire agreement. It's not a treaty to end a conflict. A treaty gives legal effect to the ending of a war, where all the claims are settled under the auspices of the treaty. Now that there's an armistice and the countries have ceased fighting, a date is set for a peace conference where the final treaty will be negotiated. And in this case, this was unfortunately for January 1919. And that's only a few months after the armistice was signed. A number of historians have questioned the wisdom of this being so close to the end of hostilities. So with the date set, Wilson is off to Paris. And he's thinking on the peace settlement and the League are two separate things. His reasoning has developed in an opposite direction from the other powers. I mean that he had come to believe that the first task for the settlement conference was the creation of the International Organization for Peace. And that was the main goal. The actual peace settlement was not. The other powers, like Britain and France, they hadn't really been consulted about this, and they wanted to do the peace settlement first and then look at the international organisation second. But Wilson insisted upon this particular order: peace organisation, then settlement conference. This particular thinking caused him, though, to drift into the belief that any problems in the peace settlement could later be fixed by the League. Now, mind you, this is a guy who's thinking that this could just be a great experience. He's not even sure this thing is going to work, but he's prepared to sign on to a peace treaty because the international organization, which he thinks might work or might be a good experience, will be able to fix it later. A big mistake, that. This sort of friction with the other powers was accentuated a bit by the fact that some of them didn't care much for the League anyway. They saw it as being an ancillary aspect of the peace settlement. The French were big supporters of the balance of power model, and they had little faith in this idea of collective security or the League or this strange movement to end war. They remained glued to the old ways of doing things. And just a note as to terminology, I have a bad habit of referring to the Paris Peace Conference as the Versailles Conference, and often using the term Versailles, Paris interchangeably. When you hear the two used, I do mean the same thing. I deserve a bit of a smack for that, but I will explain why that's the case. The final output of the Paris Peace Conference was the Treaty of Versailles. Louis XIV made his palace there at Versailles, And only one of the actual sittings of the Paris Peace Conference process was at Versailles, which was the final signing of it on the 28th of June 1919. Actually, I lie. There were actually two sessions at Versailles, one on May the 7th and the other one on the 28th of June. The May 7th session wasn't held in the Hall of Mirrors, which is where the main Versailles Palace is. It was held in the Summer Palace, which is a smaller palace on the grounds. The final German invitation is to the one that was on the 28th of June in the Hall of Mirrors in the main palace. So my apologies for that momentary lapse of accuracy. The bulk of the conference negotiations took place at the French Foreign Ministry in the city of Paris properly. Bob Carr, the former Australian Foreign Minister and Premier of New South Wales, is known to have quite the fascination with American history. A number of times he's spoken about Wilson in a book review. Once in 2014, he described Wilson as America's worst president. And Carr claims that the damage Wilson did outweighed that of any other president. And he goes on to refer to Wilson as that most dangerous of creatures, an intruding idealist on the loose. All pretty breathtaking criticism. What tends to make it even more a bit shocking is that Wilson, up to at least probably the early 2000s, Wilson himself is considered to be one of the modern heroes of the Democratic Party. The New York Times in 1996 even placed him up there with the near great presidents. Now, you could take the view that it's one of these contemporary problems with past historical figures, a bit like Thomas Jefferson and that small problem of being a slave keeper. Wilson, of course, did have personal foibles, which are not looked upon very kindly in the modern age. In fact, they were more than just foibles, but we won't get dragged down that path today. The force of the criticisms that Carr makes are ones that are contemporary to Wilson's conduct of foreign policy, and he's not alone in that criticism. You need only consider some of what his other contemporaries had to say. Winston Churchill offered his own observations in a book after the conference, and he states that Wilson was, in every main decision, a party politician, calculating and brazen. And there's a bit more in Margaret Macmillan's book, Paris 1919, the year that changed the world. She described one of the earliest meetings of the League of Nations Commission at the Versailles Conference. When the conference started, there were these specific committees that were working on aspects of the peace, and the League of Nations Committee was one of them. And there was a particular meeting, and Robert Cecil, who was a junior British minister, was attending, and Wilson was there. She quotes something that he'd written a number of years ago.
The Commission's 19 members met almost daily in House's rooms at the Crillon, seated around a large table covered with a red cloth. Behind them sat their interpreters murmuring quietly in their ears. The British and the Americans were beside each other, consulting each other continually. The French were separated from them by the Italians. The Portuguese and the Belgians were inexhaustible, the Japanese rarely uttered. Wilson, in the chair, was brisk, discouraging speeches and discussions of details and pushing the League in the direction he wanted. "I am coming to the conclusion," Cecil wrote, "that I do not personally like him. I do not know quite what it is that repels me, a certain hardness, coupled with vanity and an eye for effect."
After hearing that criticism, you might well say, well, I've just heard Bob Carr eviscerate Wilson. He's obviously not a fanboy. okay, and Churchill is a balance of power man, so that's not really that surprising. And Cecil himself had a conservative background. But what's particularly interesting is how House and Wilson fall out during the conference. So you may, to varying degrees, take these criticisms with a grain of salt. But the one you certainly can't ignore is the falling out with Colonel House. Now, as you might remember, House and Wilson were very tight. Wilson referred to House as his second personality at one point. And during the conference, there's a period where House is delegated control over the negotiations because Wilson has to go back to the United States. And during the negotiations, Wilson becomes very unhappy with him. And when he returns, their relationship becomes quite difficult. And eventually, House, by the end of the conference, is completely frozen out. After the conference concludes, they never speak to each other ever again. As House prepares to leave Paris and return to the United States, he becomes reflective about the relationship and about Wilson and his behaviour during the conference. I'll quote from Charles New's biography here on Colonel House, where House makes a scathing commentary and states that the president will rank with the great orators of all time. In truth, I believe that it is as an orator that he excels rather than as a statesman. And then he goes on to refer to this saying going around in London that Wilson talks like Jesus Christ but acts like Lloyd George. He makes this commentary later on where he says that because he's so contradictory, it's hard to pass judgment upon him. He has few friends, and the reason is apparent to me. He seems to do his best to offend rather than please. And then he goes on to say that everything that does not square with good sense seems to him not worthwhile, when as a matter of fact, all of us have to yield to prejudice, weakness, and the whims of our fellow man. We must work collectively in order to work effectively. The president understands this intellectually, for he's always saying what he does not practice. He speaks constantly of teamwork, but seldom practices it. Ah, Paris, the city of love, the site of our peace conference to settle the most colossal war in human history. And how did the city of love rub off on our participants? Well, they all arrived and they immediately began to hug it out amidst prolific tears and promises to never do that to each other ever again. Alas, if only it had gone that way. If only the heads of state at Paris had been readers of men's emotional self-help books, where they could have bonded with each other, men doing manly things with each other in the city of love. The reality of the conference was to be something else. Now that we're all in Paris, Wilson has got his way, with the focus being on the League of Nations Covenant Treaty, with the first order of business, and then the peace settlement. And the International Peace Organization will become known as the League of Nations. And for the immediate observer, the question arises fairly quickly as to, are we actually having a peace conference? How can you have a peace conference and not invite the people you're making peace with? Now, one-sided peace treaties, they're nothing new in history when you don't invite the other combatants. And when that happens, you can sort of guess that this is going to be a harsh peace. We're not really negotiating peace. Someone's imposing peace. Or, more correctly, they're imposing punishment. I think the surprising thing about Paris 1919 is that the rhetoric preceding this conference, particularly by Wilson, was absolutely at loggerheads with how this conference would eventually proceed. I mean, there's been a revolution in Germany, and the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, was overthrown. The Allies, including the United States, proceeded on the basis that not much had changed in Germany, whereas in fact, things had changed radically. And of course, we cannot mention Germany without also discussing that other bad boy of Europe, who's not at Versailles either, which is Russia, the ex-allied country. Now, Russia was strictly persona non grata at this stage. It had been an allied power, and it had its communist revolution, and conducted a separate peace with the Germans, and had exited the war on its own terms, or the best terms it could get, which weren't great at the time. And so it didn't get an invite either. Anyway, we are apparently having a peace conference, even though we didn't invite the people we're making peace with. The big topic, the big initial topic, is the new International Organization for Peace. And this is being led by Wilson. At this point, I think it would be helpful to pretend to be the hypothetical fly on the wall at the peace conference. What do you think would be the basic foundational issues you would expect to be framed at the conference? As a fly, just observing silently on the wall, what would need to be framed to form a successful international peace organization, which was going to maintain the peace in the future? Four of these could be considered as follows. Number one, membership. Number two, enforcement. Number three, dispute resolution. And number four, disarmament. With the membership, who is it to be? How is power distributed in the body amongst its members? And that also leads directly to the next two issues. How is dispute settlement to be structured? Like, who's leading the effort? What's happening with enforcement of peace? Because that's where the buck ultimately stops. If dispute settlement fails, how do you then keep the peace? How do you then enforce it? Who's got the direct burden for that task? And then lastly, of course, there's disarmament. And disarmament means the reduction of military war-making capacity. Wilson felt very strongly that disarmament was actually the most important long-term issue for any new international organization. That logic is sort of beguilingly attractive. And it sort of works like this. If you reduce arms, you have two immediate impacts. The first consequence is that it removes the use of force as a short-term solution to a dispute, since you lack the force depth to be able to effectively wage war, and which then leads to the second influence, that diplomacy becomes really the only effective way to resolve the dispute in the short term. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that these four issues are exhaustive. There were a lot of other issues, in particular, questions around the issue of self-determination were very important as well. But how then did the conference resolve those four basic matters that I've just picked out? Let's start with who were to be the members. The final shape of the League came down to it being a standing body, since the League would be split into these two component parts, Council and Assembly. and the council would consist of five permanent great power panel members: the United States, Italy, United Kingdom, France, and Japan. There'd be four other temporary members who would be elected by the Assembly. And all decisions required the unanimous agreement of all the members in the council and a majority of the Assembly. The exceptions to this were not great, and nor were they significant. So that didn't inspire a great deal of confidence. But these were early days, and over time, some different mechanism may have developed to make decision-making more effective. So let's turn to the issue of dispute resolution, and this involves what United Nations historian Claude Innes refers to as a variety of peaceful substitutes for the technique of violence. And these substitutes include third-party assistance, arbitration, abstention from hostilities, commissions of inquiry. All of these are methods of diplomacy, and they've had a serious developed history before World War I. Prior to the conference, Wilson had favoured some type of compulsory principle around arbitration. And that was a viewpoint that was held by others, but not necessarily the other states at the peace conference. But even here, and I refer to compulsory mediation, even here, that didn't even make it into the final covenant, let alone something like compulsory arbitration. And as you could well imagine, the loss of compulsory dispute resolution did not bode well for any other immediate robust disarmament measures. I mean, if you couldn't even get that into the covenant, I mean, how are you going to get disarmament measures in there? Disarmament measures that did make it into the covenant were weak and fairly meaningless. Now, just as a bit of an aside here, whilst the League Covenant disarmament measures were not particularly impressive, some disarmament measures did make it into the actual treaty, the final peace treaty, the Treaty of Versailles. These were about reducing the German army to about the size of a glorified police force and allowing the other Allied states to arm to the teeth without any restrictions. And I've just realised I've overlooked the issue of enforcement, which I haven't discussed how that ended up in the covenant. Really, enforcement is a bit of a nothing in the covenant. There's no military staff, neither autonomous or supplied by the other powers, and certainly there's no military forces. Then there's no compellability in relation to other enforcement measures like sanctions. And similar to the other key issues, it just seems like more hot air. The end result was a final covenant that you could definitely say was collective security light. I don't have any historical evidence on this because I haven't really gone looking for it. But if I was a committed activist involved in the wartime peace movement, I would have said that result would have been underwhelming. Now, you could say that something of substance was achieved. There was a foundation for future efforts. I don't think you could say that the cause of international peace was put back. It wasn't damaged by the creation of the League. And some of the focus too on self-determination became a bit of a ticking time bomb for the practices of the old imperialism. Our fly on the wall at this point probably would have concluded that yes, we have collective security Bud Light. I'm sorry, collective security light. And it's really a bit of an aspiration. It's interesting that Wilson had almost arrived at that point. And I refer here to some more correspondence that Thomas Nock relies upon. And I'll refer to it directly. Nock is writing about Wilson's thoughts in the days after writing the second Paris draft of the covenant. There's a conversation that Wilson has with the president of Switzerland. From this, Nock concludes that Wilson is really intending the league to serve as a guide, as a type of compass. He quotes Wilson in that only the essential lines could be immediately traced, and that the rest will be the fruit of long labour and repeated experiences. And Nock adds this other conclusion, that the league was to Wilson a type of constitution. Its practical meaning, though, would depend upon its executors in the course of decades. Now, I have to clarify one thing before I forget to do so, and this concerns the covenant and the treaty. And I'm harking back here a little bit to where I say that the covenant, the League of Nations covenant, it doesn't really set the cause of peace back. The actual covenant and the peace treaty are actually one document. There is one formal instrument that emerges from the conference. And the Treaty of Versailles is split into a number of different parts. And the first part is the covenant regarding the League of Nations. So the two conventions were not really detached. They were one convention. So if you discover in the podcast that I've sort of misled you and indicated it there too, well, there's something you can email me a complaint about. The dangerous bits of the treaty, the bits where there's an argument that the cause of peace was damaged in the future, are to be found in the main provisions of the Versailles Treaty itself. One example of what I'd be talking about is the War Guilt Clause. So in conclusion, you have to ask yourself how this ridiculous confection of circumstances and treaties was really, in the end, any better than a balance of power settlement. If Henry Kissinger had been invited, you could just imagine the look of disdain on his face as he watched these rank amateurs construct this settlement. And in fact, if you offered Henry Kissinger the opportunity to comment, he would have been quite blunt. Oh, in fact, he did comment on this in his 1994 book, Diplomacy. And he makes one very, very solid point, which was that to have concluded a war where you didn't invite the two strongest powers in Europe to the event, which between them contained well over half of Europe's population and by far the largest military potential, that alone just made what you were doing utterly useless. The final sitting of the conference was to be conducted in the Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles, the 28th of June 1919. And if there was any doubt that this peace conference was anything but a punishment conference, one need only consider the symbolism that was embedded in the events. And of course, the Germans do get their final invitation, which is on the last day when they get given the text to sign, without being consulted about any of the principles. That now brings us to the end of Studies in Foreign Policy, Collective Security, Part 1. And if you want to catch up with any of our other podcasts, there's a few of them that you can listen to, and keep an eye out for the sequel to this, Part 2. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to our email address, which is crowdtalks, CROWDTALKS, all one word, at proton.me. Once again, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Thank you.